history. Not just the single most influential opera, my friends, the single most influential composition, along with Beethoven's Ninth, of the 19th century. Its influence is felt well into the 20th century. Tristan and Isolde is a sort of musical equivalent of Schopenhauer's doctrine that existence is an inherently insatiable web of longings, willings, and strivings from which the only permanent liberation is the cessation of being. In Tristan and Isolde, both Tristan and Isolde ultimately embrace death, not only as the cessation of their otherwise unfulfillable longing, but also as the loss of self-identity in an ultimate merging with one another. Now, of course, on the basis of Schopenhauer's philosophy, they will be united not just with themselves, but with everything and everybody else that has died as well. As Robert Donegan, oh, that includes, my friends, buses and plants and rabbis. Wagner's not going to like that part of Schopenhauer's philosophy. As Robert Donegan points out, whatever Buddhist annihilation may mean, it does not mean that the journey ends with lovers meeting. And he's right. It doesn't. Oh, well. Like Sport and Life in Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, who sings, "I take the gospel whenever it's possible, but with a grain of salt." Might I suggest that Wagner will take the gospel of Schopenhauer only up to the point at which it's useful. And that, my friends, is as it should be. All right. Tristan and Isolde begins with an introduction, an overture, a prelude. This is an opera about unfulfilled emotional and sexual passion. How does this overture prepare us for such a story? Let us listen, talk about it briefly, take our lecture break, and talk about it some more. How does this overture prepare us for a story about unfulfilled emotional passion? How does this overture prepare us for a story about unfulfilled emotional and sexual passion? Well, it does it real well because it in itself feels unfulfilled. We don't have a tonal center. We don't have a beat. Instead, we have these slithering and sliding cadences. Nothing satisfactorily resolves, and nothing will until the last chord of the opera as Isolde expires in about 5 hours. Now, is this any way to begin a 5-hour opera? Well, you bet it is. Wagner creates tension as we wait for the music to resolve, to get somewhere, and it never really does. This is, of course, symbolic of Tristan and Isolde's earthly relationship, unconsummated, unrequited, profoundly unsatisfying. Now, not everyone liked waiting so long for something to happen. Edward Hanslick, the famed music critic and contemporary of Wagner's, wrote, "The prelude to Tristan and Isolde reminds me of the old Italian paintings of a martyr whose intestines are slowly unwound from the body on a reel." Rossini wrote, "Mr. Wagner's music has beautiful moments, but bad quarters of an hour." Yes, indeed, we must be patient with Wagner's time demands. His particular artistic megalomania demands not just our attention, but great chunks of our time. On that note, let us take our lecture break. When we return, Tristan and Isolde will talk about the three acts as based on three actions. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 27, the second of a two-lecture set entitled Richard Wagner and Tristan and Isolde. We pick back up with a couple of overview statements, and then we move directly to the music. Tristan and Isolde is an opera in three acts based on three actions. Act one. The essential action is the drinking of the love potion. Act two, the essential action is the mortal wounding of Tristan. And in Act three, the death of both Tristan and Isolde. Now let us go back to the moment during which the drink is drought. Act one, the famous filter or horned cup scene, the drinking of the love, death, whatever, potion. All right, please, an essential leitmotif review. Just as a reminder, because we're going to hear lots of these in just a minute. First, the drink-death motive, representing, as it does, the physical action of drinking, the action of liquid going down, but of course also the death that Isolde believes this drink will bring about. The dissonance inherent in the harmony, representing the dissonance that this will cause, the lack of stability, the lack of anchoring that will result from this harmonic dissonance. All right, then we had a new motive added to this one, the desire motif. I keep saying motive and motif. They're the same thing. I grew up in a part of the country where to say motif would have one branded as a hopeless snot, and you'd probably have all parts of your body twisted and bent as a result. So it would be better to say motive from where I'm from. But, of course, Wagner calls them leitmotifs. So I would use motif apropos of Wagner. You'll excuse me for slipping in and out of my native tongue, as it were. In any case, the desire motif is attached to the, if you'll excuse me, butt end of our drink death motif this way. And now desire. And let's hear that drink death desire motif. Now, please, let's go back to the overture. The first thing we hear when we sit down and listen to this orchestral prelude is the drink, death, desire motif three times, each time a little higher than the last. So we're always being ratcheted up higher, 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 but with a total lack of resolution. Then we hear a portion of the desire motif played this way. All this rising stuff and all these silences in between the rising stuff, creating ever more yearning for resolution. And finally, it seems that the music is about to resolve. We get this. And we expect this. And you know what? We would have had a resolution. That's not going to happen for 5 hours. This is what Wagner gives us. Instead of, we get, that is called in musical parlance a deceptive cadence or a false cadence. The music did not resolve to where we expected it to, but to somewhere else. And this whole prelude, this whole opera, is in many ways one gigantic deceptive cadence after another where nothing goes where it should. You know, I've used this simile before, and I'll use it again. This is like walking around with bologna in your shoes. Every time you take a step, you think your foot is down, but then you slide somewhere or another. The harmony keeps lubing us in directions we don't expect to go. And this is one of the essential ways that Wagner creates this sense of incompletion, of unrequited harmonic resolution. That is the parallel to the unrequited love, which is the essence of the dramatic line of this opera. False cadences. Yes, that rising desire motive never rises to a satisfactory resolution. Always to these false resolutions, these false cadences. Now, please, I want to play for you again the opening of the overture. And now I want you to be aware of these elements. First, the drink death desire motif, heard three times in succession. Each one higher than the last, always ratcheting up the drama one step. Then more isolated versions of the rising desire motif until finally we seem to be on the verge of resolution, and then all of this greasy, slick, oily irresolution as represented by the deceptive cadences. It is a brilliantly wrought overture. It predicts absolutely the essential dramatic action that is to come. Yeah, it's an extraordinary and beautiful overture, and it serves the dramatic function of the piece magnificently. All right, please let us move on to Act 1, Scene 5, the famous filter or horned cup drinking scene. We are now well reminded of our essential motivic content, and we are armed to do battle with this scene. Please recall now, Tristan has been invited by Isolde for a drink, and he knows in his heart of heart, in his soul of souls, this could be the last drop that greases this particular tongue for this particular lifetime. Sailors outside are already yelling, "Haul the line, drop the anchor." Indeed, they have arrived at Cornwall. Tristan, starting wildly. Oh, and by the way, we're going to move through this text very slowly. It's lengthy. This is going to take us a couple of minutes. Two reasons why we must take our time through the text. First of all, it's Wagner's own. He wrote this libretto as he wrote all his libretti, and he indulges in a kind of this, thou, thine, oh, mythological language that he almost created by himself for his operatic purposes. So I want you to hear, at least in translation, the sound of Wagner's language. Secondly, every word is pregnant with meaning, allegorical meaning, metaphorical meaning, metaphysical meaning, and we've got to deal with the layers of meaning in the text before we can understand the layers of meaning in the music. So bear with me. The sailors outside, haul the line, drop the anchor. Tristan, starting wildly, drop the anchor, stern to the current, sail and mast to the wind. Now, why does Wagner tell Tristan, starting wildly, to shout out, drop the anchor, stern to the current, sail and mast to the wind? He's off with Isolde. The men probably can't hear him right now. In any case, who is he really shouting at? He's shouting at himself. He's referring to the fact that now I must make my stand. Now my honor is more important than anything else. Now I must be brave in the face of what undoubtedly will be my death. Drop my anchor, my stern to the current, my sail and mast to the wind. He takes the cup from Isolde. Well know I Ireland's queen and her art's magic. So he's basically looking her in the eye and say, I know there's something in here. I've been there before, honey. The balsam I used that she brought, the goblet I now take, so that I might altogether today recover. Recover from what? What is he taking in this goblet that will help him recover? He wants to recover from his shame, which is frankly for him worse than the wounds that she nursed him back from. He wants perhaps also to recover, and now I suggest something we haven't suggested before, he wants to recover from his love for Isolde. Yes, there's all kinds of talk about whether the stuff in the cup is just a placebo if Tristan and Isolde already adore each other. Whatever, he's looking at this cup as the antidote, the cure for his shame, the cure for his love. What's the cure? Death. He continues, and heed also the oath of atonement, which I thankfully made to you. Tristan's honor, Tristan's era. We hear another very important leitmotif, and I'm going to point it out now. Tristan's era. Yes, Tristan's era. His honor has been in the toilet since he accepted from Isolde, the healing hand. This honor motif will be very, very, very important in Acts 2 and 3, when his honor is increasingly called into question. After all, he's fooling around with his uncle's wife. His uncle happens to be the king. Not the greatest of people to fool around behind the back on. In any case, Tristan's honor, highest truth, Tristan's anguish, brave defiance. He is anguished about his honor, and he feels he must recover it. Betrayal of the heart, dream of presentiment, eternal sorrow, unique solace. Forgettings, kindly drought, I drink without wavering. He's convinced he's going to die, but at least he can forget what has gone before. He sits and he drinks. Isolde cries out. Oh, she is a crying lady up to this point. Betrayed even in this? The half is mine. And before he can drink the whole thing down, of course, she wrests the cup from his hand. Traitor, I drink to you. Ich trink sie dir. And she swallows what's left and she throws the cup across the floor. Both, seized with shuddering, gaze at each other with the deepest agitation, still with stiff demeanor, as the expression of defiance of death fades into a glow of passion. And of course, for the actors, I'm not calling them singers now because they're acting. For the actors, this has to be convincing and not just silly looking, as they're prepared to die and their features soften and suddenly passion appears on their faces instead. Trembling grips them. They convulsively clutch their hearts and pass their hands over their brows. Then they seek each other with their eyes, sink into confusion, and once more turn with renewed longing towards each other. Now, during all this pantomime, we hear the overture return. Yadim, and the desire motive is now attached to the rear end of the drink death motive, and we realize drink death have equaled desire. And all that material we heard in the overture, including the deceptive cadences, returns as they stare quivering at each other. Was it a placebo, as some have suggested? Maybe. They expected to die, and when they didn't, perhaps their true emotions were allowed to come out. One way or the other, the rest of the opera will be very different from that preceded the drink. I continue. Isolde, with wavering voice. Tristan. Tristan, overwhelmed. Isolde. And false cadences, right and left, everywhere, as they can't even sense where they are or perhaps even who they are. Isolde, sinking onto his chest. Treacherous lover. Tristan. Divine woman. He embraces her with ardor. They remain in silent embrace. Please remember the stage directions I'm reading you are Wagner's own. All the men outside. Hail! Hail! King Mark! King Mark! Hail! Yes, life is going on and continuing even as Tristan and Isolde's reality is completely skewed. And this is a reminder of that reality. Brangaena, she's the one who did all of this, my friends. She's the maid who mixed the love potion, who, with averted face, full of confusion and horror, turns to see the pair sunk in a love embrace and hurls herself, wringing her hands, into the foreground. Oh, woe is me! Woe is me! Inevitable, endless distress instead of quick death. Misleading truth, deceitful work now blossoms pitifully upwards. Tristan and Isolde break their embrace. Tristan, bewildered. What did I dream? Of Tristan's honor? It's gone, Buster. Absolutely gone. Isolde. What did I dream? Of Isolde's disgrace? And everywhere we're hearing these rising desire motives. We know what they're feeling now. Nothing but pure desire. Tristan. Are you lost to me? Isolde. Have you repulsed me? Tristan, starting to get a sense of what's happened. False magic's nasty trick, Isolde says. Foolish wrath's vain menace. But they can't maintain this sense of reality. Tristan, Isolde, sweetest maiden. Isolde, Tristan, most beloved man. And then a duet, unbelievably exquisite and moving. They sing together. How heaving our hearts are uplifted, how all our senses blissfully quiver, longing passion, swelling blooms, languishing love, blessed glow. Precipitate in the breast exulting desire. Isolde, Tristan, Tristan, Isolde, escaped from the world, you have won me. You, my only thought, highest love's desire. It's an unbelievably beautiful passage. The curtains are now drawn completely aside. The entire ship is filled with knights and sailors who joyfully signal the shore from aboard the ship. Nearby is seen a cliff crowned by a castle. Tristan and Isolde remain lost in mutual contemplation, unaware of what is taking place. They are already, my friends, in another world, a separate reality. Brangaena to the women who at her bidding ascend from below. Quick, quick, the royal robe, rushing between Tristan and Isolde. Up, unfortunate pair, up. See where we are? She puts the royal cloak on Isolde, who does not notice anything. the men again cheer. Hail, hail, King Mark, hail. Kerwinol, Tristan's dude Friday, advances cheerfully. Hail, Tristan, fortunate hero. With splendid courtiers, there in the skiff, Mark approaches. Ah, how the ride delights him, for soon he will be wooing the bride. Ha, 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 ha. Tristan, looking up, bewildered. Who comes? And Kerwinol answers, the king. And Tristan inquires, which king? Yes, Kerwinol points. Tristan stares, stupefied, at the shore. All the men waving their hats, hail, King Mark! Isolde, completely confused. Mark, what does he want? What is that, Brangaena? What is all the shouting? And we hear the drink motive to remind us again what has brought this on. Brangaena says, Isolde, mistress, get a hold of yourself! And Isolde says, where am I? Am I alive? Oh, what drink was it? Brangaena, despairingly. Der Liebestrank, the love potion. Isolde stares, frightened at Tristan. Really, she's horrified. Tristan? And Tristan stares back. Isolde? Isolde falls fainting upon his chest. Must I live? Brangaena to the women. Help your mistress, Tristan. Realizing what has happened, oh, rapture full of cunning, oh, fraudulently won, good fortune. And the men keep cheering in general acclaim. Hail the king! Hail Cornwall! People have climbed over the ship's side, others have extended a bridge, and the atmosphere is one of expectation of the arrival of those who have been awaited as the curtain falls on Act One. Wow. Wow. We got to listen to this scene now. It's an amazing scene of metamorphosis from pre-drink Tristan and Isolde through the music of the overture once again, which, of course, they pantomime to, and then this extraordinary change of heart, of character, of reality that represents, frankly, the rest of the opera. Please note the following. Continuous music. Obviously, there are no breaks. There is no differentiation between recitative and aria, arioso, and recitative, all is through composed. The orchestra is equal in importance to the voices. Note the incredible dramatic thrust, utterly true to the text, and of course, this amazing, truly exquisitely amazing music. Music grown from native German roots, not from Italian or French operatic tradition. All right, let's listen. It's an extraordinary finale, if we could call it that. I cannot encourage you more than to say, please, use your libretto when you can. Not when you're driving, but to look at the words and follow the music while you're looking at the words makes such a difference. The comprehensibility, the understanding of the actions. Our imaginations come alive and we see the performance. We imagine the stage set. We're aware of movement if we can follow the words while we hear the music. And certainly, in a Wagnerian music drama like this, there's so much happening all at once. There's so many important things going on in the orchestra. There's so much activity that without the words, everything potentially can get mushed together. And if you'll excuse my use of a technical term there. And we would rather that didn't happen because this is music. These are words of infinite interest. And we want to do everything we can to get the maximum we can out of them. So when possible, follow your libretto. All right, Act Two. Tristan and Isolde engage in a 30-plus minute duet in which they sing, seemingly endlessly, of their love and lust for each other. Composer and critic Virgil Thompson claimed that there are moments clearly marked in Wagner's score that indicate, and now I quote Virgil Thompson, that indicate during the duet that the lovers ejaculate simultaneously seven times, unquote. Thank you, Virgil, for sharing that with us. This may or may not be. This same duet inspired the following anecdote told by Ethan Morden, Toscanini on Wagnerian pacing. At Salzburg, Toscanini was sitting in on a Bruno Walter rehearsal of Tristan and Isolde with Margarita Wallmann. During the very long love duet in Act Two, Maestro Toscanini turned to Wallmann and said, quote, if they were Italians, they would already have seven children. But see, they're Germans. They're still talking it over. Unquote. Act Two draws to its conclusion with Tristan and Isolde betrayed and Tristan mortally wounded. Act Three. Isolde goes to the dying Tristan. He dies in her arms, and she sings her famous love death, the Liebestod. Wagner calls this section Verklärung, the transfiguration, the moment at which Tristan and Isolde's unbridled and unconsummated passion evolves to be realized at a higher plane. The Liebestod constitutes a moment of really transcendent beauty and quietude. It's the climax of the opera, and we will hear it. Now, at the conclusion of the Liebestod, as Isolde transcends her earthly plane, there is, for the first time in the opera, a truly unambiguous harmonic resolution, and with it, dramatic completion, as the upwards desire motive finally resolves and comes to rest. Isolde, unconscious of all around her, turning her eyes on Tristan's body with rising inspiration. See him smiling softly, gently, mild und leise, softly, gently. See the eyes that open fondly. Oh, my friends, here, don't you see? Ever lighter, how he's shining. Look, Tristan's dead. And whether she's being delusional or seeing something the others cannot is immaterial. She's in a different place. Born on high amid the stars, don't you see how his heart so bravely swells, full and calm it throbs in his breast? How from lips so joyful mild, sweet the breath that softly stirs. Friends, see, don't you feel and see? It is only I who hear these gentle, wondrous strains of music, joyous sounding, telling all things, reconciling, sounding from him, piercing through me, rising upwards, echoes fondly, round me ringing, and so forth. The words, frankly, are unimportant at this point. She's aware that she is transcending, and she is. She's virtually evolving into something else, and at the conclusion, she simply sinks down as if transfigured, dead in Brangaena's arms upon the body of Tristan. End Act Three, end opera. Let's listen to this extraordinary love death, so-called, and then draw our conclusions. You know, I'm reminded in listening to that of Monteverdi's task when he writes Possente Spiritu for Orfeo. This is when Orfeo has to convince Charon to take him across the river to the underworld. It's at that moment that Monteverdi has to imbue Orpheus with the ultimate degree of lyric art, because only Orpheus's lyric art at its very highest can change the heart of a god. Well, so Wagner, here in the Liebestod, has to reach the highest level of his lyric art, because the music must be as transcendent as the new reality that Isolde is already seeing as she approaches her death. And of course, he succeeds. He succeeds brilliantly. In a compositional career filled with masterworks, Tristan and Isolde is Wagner's magnum opus. Concluding statements, please. Wagner remains a paradox, a man possessed of the best and worst human attributes. From the mid-19th century to the early 20th century, Wagner's music, dramas, and his ideas aroused storms of endless controversy. One either was a believer or not. Whole careers, my friends, were based on whether one was within or without of the Wagnerian cult. The impresario Max Maritzek wrote, quote, "I never discuss politics, religion, or Wagner. It always makes for bad blood and originates quarrels," unquote. Now, today we have a more measured view of Mr. Wagner. Ultimately, he and Verdi arrived at the same place, continuous music, continuous drama, though they got there from completely different directions. Ultimately, whether we like Wagner the man or not is completely immaterial. He left us with an extraordinary musical legacy and changed forever the music, the opera that followed him. Thank you. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 28, a lecture entitled Late Romantic German Opera, Richard Strauss and Salome. One lecture, my friends, on the operas of Richard Strauss. That's like having but one sip of a great Margot, like spending only one day in Paris, or eating, God forbid, but one potato chip. Oh, the pain of it all. We persevere, but with the understanding that one lecture can offer us but the teensiest little taste of this remarkable composer of remarkable operas. In his time, Richard Strauss was hailed as Wagner's successor. His contemporaries called him Richard II. Unlike Wagner, though, Strauss came to opera composing relatively late in his compositional career. Strauss spent the first part of his career writing a series of extraordinary tone poems, purely orchestral works which, in reality, function like instrumental operas in that each one of these tone poems tells a specific story and invokes explicit visual imagery. We should think of these tone poems as operas without words. For example, Don Juan of 1888 tells the story of Don Juan, but in purely musical terms. Death and Transfiguration of 1889. Macbeth of 1890. Also Sprach Zarathustra of 1894. Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks of 1895. Don Quixote of 1897. And A Hero's Life of 1898. Strauss's operas. He was a master of the genre from the beginning. But this should come as no surprise to us, because for all intents and purposes, he had already honed the craft of distinctive, dramatic, descriptive music in his writing of his tone poems. His first operas were Guntram of 1894 and Feuersnot of 1901. His last opera was Capriccio of 1942. Strauss's three great operas, the operas which made him rich and famous and which have remained in the repertoire since the day they were premiered, were written back to back. They are Salome of 1905, Elektra of 1909 and Der Rosenkavalier of 1911. And I would also point out that the librettist for Elektra and Der Rosenkavalier was the wonderful and extremely good Hugo Hofmannsthal. We will focus on the remarkable and controversial Salome, and I leave it to you, please, to investigate the bone-chilling Elektra and the glorious lyric opera buffa-like Rosenkavalier. All right, please, a quick biography. He was born in Munich on June 11, 1864. Richard's father was Franz Strauss. Franz Strauss was the most famous French horn player in Germany. He was opinionated, he was outspoken, and what he was most opinionated and outspoken about was his rabid dislike of romantic modernism. Richard Strauss's father, Franz, considered Wagner a dangerous subversive. Franz Strauss adored classicism. Now, Franz Strauss was not just some crazy person standing on a street corner and yelling about these things. As I said, he was the most famous horn player in all of Germany and the principal horn player in the Munich Opera Orchestra. This means that he participated in the world premieres of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, as well as Wagner's Die Meistersinger, the Mastersinger of Nuremberg. Apparently, Franz Strauss was constantly getting into fights with the conductor, Hans von Bülow, and even with Wagner himself. Franz Strauss claimed that Wagner had no idea how to write for the horn. He played his parts so beautifully that Wagner did his best to ignore his nasty comments and belligerent behavior. Yes, what you say between the gaps of the piece is one thing, but if you play well during the rehearsals and performance, I will probably leave you alone. Franz Strauss saw to it that his phenomenally talented young son, Richard, got the best music education that his money and his position could buy. Richard was trained as a pianist, as a violinist, as a conductor, and as a composer. And I would point out, in Franz Strauss's great credit, to his great credit, he did not push his son, Richard, to be one of these early performers. No concert tours at the age of 10, no exposing him to an adult world before he was prepared to deal with it. The phenomenal talent his son had was, if not kept under wraps, then it was kept quiet. His son received the most extraordinary training you can imagine a musician receiving at this time, and the wonderful experience of hearing live music all the time. So Strauss was not just well-trained, but he was well-maintained as a human being and didn't suffer from many of the problems we see so-called prodigies suffer from as they grow up and find the world more difficult for them to deal with than they thought it would be. Now, Richard, in Franz Strauss's opinion, Richard's classically oriented compositional training fell apart, disintegrated, went kaput as soon as Richard was exposed to the romantic riffraff, composers like Berlioz, Liszt, and Wagner. Yes, sooner or later, the young Richard is going to want to meet the people who are hot, the rock and rollers, the geeters with the heaters, that are doing the big things at this time. And indeed, Franz Strauss was very unhappy. He felt his son had basically thrown away his life and his education. Once Richard Strauss found his mature voice, and he found it fairly young, based as it was on Berlioz, Liszt, and Wagner, maturity and fame came rapidly. Harold Schoenberg tells us, from 1888, when Don Juan had its premiere, till 1911, when Der Rosenkavalier was first staged, the most discussed and controversial man of European music was Richard Strauss. His symphonic poems were considered the last word in shocking modernism, and his Salome in 1905 and Elektra in 1909 caused riots and scandals. It was to be expected that the conservatives should dislike Strauss's new music, and it would be a complete waste of all of our time for me to start reading to you all of the anti-Strauss literature from the various conservative thinkers and philosophers and composers of this age. Obviously, someone like Richard Strauss will be rejected by what we might consider the conservative stream. But even those allied to the progressives had many nasty things to say. For example, Gian Francesco Malpiero in Italy, who should have automatically sided with Strauss's music of the future, curtly dismissed Strauss as, quote, the Meyerbeer of the 20th century, unquote. We now know, my friends, how scathing and cutting a comment that really is. Gustav Mahler, on the other hand, called Salome a work of genius. Well, Malpiero was wrong, and Mahler was right. The Strauss craze reached its peak between the years 1905 and 1907 with the premiere and popularization of Salome, for which he was accused of immorality. 1907, the Metropolitan Opera, after one performance, Salome had to be removed because of the public outcry it had evoked. The New York press was beside itself with rage over this one performance of Salome. Lawrence Gilman, a very influential and important critic at the turn of the century, wrote that he had been bored during its performance. Look, this is a matter of post-traumatic stress syndrome. I was bored. It has also been pointed out that one of the nastiest things a critic can do is to claim to have been bored. Usually, if a critic writes this, assume the opposite. This kind of tired, cynicism with music usually reflects the opposite, that they were scandalized, and they won't admit to that, because to admit to being scandalized is in some ways to promote that very thing that scandalized you. So many critics will simply say, oh, I fell asleep. No, they did not. Critic Henry Krabel was rather more honest. He called Salome, quote, a moral stench. A New York paper headline called Salome a loathsome opera. A letter to the editor of a New York paper read in part, are we to have our women, our children, sons and daughters witness this spectacle? Unquote. You know, whenever we want to invoke something, we always mention our children, as if our children are going to the opera house on a school night. Of course, the Baptists went on record against the opera, as did the Archbishop of Vienna. Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany was unhappy that Strauss, theretofore an upright moral German, had written Salome. The Kaiser wrote, quote, I really like the fellow, but this will do him a lot of damage, unquote. Yes, the damage, Strauss dryly remarked years later, enabled me to build my villa at Garmisch. Strauss made a lot of money out of Salome and out of his other works. We leave the last critical comment of Salome to Strauss's father, Franz, the arch-conservative and anti-Wagnerian. Shortly before his death, Strauss played Franz part of the nearly completed score, and the old man remarked thusly, oh, God, what nervous music! It is exactly as if one had one's trousers full of Maybugs, unquote. Thanks, Dad. All right. The story, its adaptation, and the libretto. The biblical tale of Salome is found in Matthew, and I would quickly read it to you. But when Herod's birthday was kept, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod, whereupon he promised with an oath to give her whatsoever she would ask. And she, being instructed of her mother, said, give me here John the Baptist's head in a charger. And the king was sorry. Nevertheless, for oath's sake, and them which sat with him at meat, he commanded it be given to her. And he sent and beheaded John in prison. And his head was brought in a charger and given to the damsel, and she brought it to her mother. John, or Yochanan in Hebrew, lived and stirred up his religious revival around the year 30 in Galilee during the reign of Herod Antipas. John believed he'd been chosen by God to announce the coming of the Messiah. John was arrested and imprisoned by Herod Antipas, partly because of his ceaseless criticism of Herod Antipas's wife, Herodias, who Herod had illegally married. Herodias's 16-year-old daughter, by her first marriage, was the beautiful and sultry Salome. Oscar Wilde, the author, was fascinated by the story of Salome. His play, also named Salome, written in 1892, is filled with a degree of eroticism, intrigue, sexual obsession, and perversion that goes only about a gazillion light years past the biblical account I just read to you. Wilde's play was hugely controversial, hugely sensational, and was not produced until 1896, by which time Wilde himself was languishing in an English prison because of his overt homosexuality. Using a translation of Wilde's Salome, prepared by Hedwig Lachmann, Strauss, if you'll excuse me, made like a Vegematic, sliced and diced the play to meet his specifications, and completed the opera in 1905, 9 years after the play had first been performed. Now, Salome is completely within the Wagnerian style. The orchestra is dominant, the music is continuous throughout, there are leitmotifs, the texture is thick and filled with polyphony. The voiced parts are mostly arioso. Strauss's harmony, which sounded so daring in its time, is no longer novel, but even more, we can now appreciate the extraordinary degree of expressivity Strauss's harmony brings to this story. Technically, this opera may be regarded as a continuation of Wagner, but frankly, it is more dissonant than Wagner. It's a kind of piece of music which assumes familiarity with Wagner on our, the listener's, part. All right, with these ideas in mind, let's proceed. Here's our game plan and our quick observation of this piece. We're going to meet the main characters, John and Salome. We will listen to the scene during which Herod asks Salome to dance, and then we will go immediately to the end of the opera and the horrific denouement, that is, the revelation of the last pages. I set the scene. The scene is set on a great terrace next to the banqueting hall in the palace of Herod. Naboth, captain of the guard, a page of Herodias, and two soldiers are guarding a cistern in which John the Baptist is imprisoned. In a nearby room, Herod is giving a banquet. All right, Naboth, the captain of the guard, has what will turn out to be a terminal crush on Salome. He anticipates Salome's entrance with the following lines. And he's looking into the banquet hall, and he sees her sitting there, and she is, of course, the soul of desire for him. The princess rises. She's leaving the table. She looks very troubled. She's coming this way. And the page of Herodias says, "Do not look at her." Naboth, "Yes, yes, she is coming towards us." The page of Herodias says, "I pray you not to look at her." And Naboth says, "She is like a dove that has strayed." Salome's entrance. Salome enters very excited. "I will not stay. I cannot stay. Why does the tetrarch," that means Herod, "why does the tetrarch look at me all the while with his mole's eyes under his shaking eyelids? It is strange that the husband of my mother looks at me like that." And important leitmotifs just fly by at light speed. There is no time for us to define them. Following this line, a surreal, almost Viennese waltz-like orchestral interlude well portrays Salome's mercurial mood swings. We can almost see her going, "Oh, la-di-da, la-di-do. How sweet the air is here. I can breathe here. Within there are Jews from Jerusalem who are tearing each other to pieces over their foolish ceremonies. Silent, subtle Egyptians and brutal, coarse Romans with their uncouth jargon. Ah, how I loathe the Romans." Again, Salome's mood changes. Ominous, low instruments accompany Salome's description of the odious guests inside in the banquet. The page of Herodias says to Naboth, "Something terrible will happen. Why do you look at her?" Again, a brief waltz-like interlude signals another mood change for Salome. Look, is she just immature? Is she a ditz? Or is she dangerously moody? Perhaps a little of all. "How good to see the moon. She is like a silver flower, cold and chaste. Yes, I am sure she is a virgin, and she has a virgin's beauty." And then the voice of John cuts through. "The Lord hath come. The Son of Man hath come." He speaks from the cistern. Salome says,